You have come to our very first Iowa Summer Writing Festival 11th hour lecture presentation of the season. It is wonderful to see you here. If you did not meet me last night, my name is Margaret LeMay, and I am the Associate Director for the Iowa Summer Writing Festival, and I am also coordinating the 11th hour lecture series this summer. So I hope I will see you very often, certainly this week. If you are here for the festival, and if you are joining us from the public, welcome so much. Okay, let's start by spending some excellent time with the amazing Iowa Summer Writing Festival faculty member, Sabrina Ora Mark. Sabrina is the author of two books of poetry and a forthcoming collection of stories entitled Wild Milk, from which we may receive a special sneak preview today, but I don't know. She holds an MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop and a PhD from the University of Georgia, and she is the recipient of numerous prestigious awards. Today, Sabrina will discuss naming, or that's Mrs. Nobody to you, and or a lecture on naming characters to life. Thank you, Sabrina.
Okay, can you guys hear me? Good. Is this work? Okay, great. Thank you, Margaret, and welcome. So today I'm going to talk about the act of naming in stories and poems. How do we choose the names we give to the characters and figures in our stories and poems? How does a name give a character charge or mark it, or erase it, or illuminate it? How can a name be used as a veil or a cape, an echo or a halo? What are the joys and pitfalls of using the names of the living and the dead inside acts of the imagination? So here we go. I'm gonna start with a story about my children. My son wakes up crying. He had a nightmare I was tearing a dragonfly to shreds. "Why did you do that, Mama?" All day he is distant. "I'm sorry," I say, "I didn't, I did, I don't know." My younger son, a few months later, all morning gives me side eye. "Come give me a hug," I say. "No," he says. "Why?" I ask. "Because you shot the moon." "Why did you do that, Mama? Why did you shoot the moon?" "But I didn't shoot the moon," I say. "Yes," he says. "You did," he says. "I dreamed it." Poor dead moon. Poor shredded dragonfly. According to Flannery O'Connor, art requires a delicate adjustment of the outer and inner worlds in such a way that without changing their nature, they can be seen through each other. In my forthcoming collection of stories, Wild Milk, there are a lot of names. A baby is accidentally referred to as Shreds. There is a husband named Louis C.K., a cleaning woman named Hillary Clinton, a man named Ferguson, a president named Ha. There is Emily Dickinson and Samuel Beckett, and a mother who is not a mother named John Berryman, and a place called Aleppo. There was a man named King. G was silent, but he was cut from the manuscript. "This is so nice," writes Gertrude Stein in Tender Buttons, "and sweet, and yet there comes the change. There comes the time to press more air. This does not mean the same as disappearance." In a torn-up world, Stein's Tender Buttons, her biography of objects, food, and rooms, which she wrote in 1914, tears the sentence up and makes out-of-word assemblages a kind of nonsense that stages the word as a thing infused with fingers that points the word away from itself. Stein cracks open the shell that has kept the word, but does not abandon the cracked up word. Wrench does not dissolve it, nor does it vanish when its keeper or shell or name vanishes. Instead, Stein sweeps up the offspring of its shatter, its deadness, its paralysis, and through a kind of syntactical bartering, she returns the word to a world saturated in its own exile. So Stein, for example, defines asparagus as asparagus in a lean too hot. This makes it art, and it is wet, wet weather, we weather wet. Or rhubarb is Susan, not seat in bunch toys, not wild and laughable, not in little places, not in neglect and vegetable, not in fold, coal age, not please. Once, many years ago, I caught a flash of Gertrude Stein in the vegetable aisle at the supermarket. Pathmark, I think it was. Some things in her shopping cart were beaming with possibility and forgetfulness, but the rest of the things were trying to climb out. I am very fascinated by names and how they infuse the atmosphere and morph. My husband, for example, is not really named Louis C.K., and the child named Eli in one of my stories is not my child named Eli, and Hillary Clinton never cleaned my stove. When I write my mother, it is not my real mother, and when I write my father, it is not my real father. While Stein cracks open the word shell and spills out its meaning and replaces it with strange contents, I string the name up, and like a light bulb and a wire, I watch it sway back and forth to see, I think, how much the story changes the wattage of the name and how much the name sends a kind of glare across the story. And so when we use the names of the living, like Hillary Clinton or Louis C.K. or Francine Prose, the hope is that the story is strong enough, the fiction of it, to bear the thump of their heartbeat. So, for example, I wrote the Louis C.K. story before the other Louis C.K. story. My publisher agreed the story still works, but differently now, like a town after a flood. Same with Hillary Clinton. I wrote the story in 2012, before the election. This puts, of course, the story at the risk of being a kind of living object, one susceptible to change and triumph and endless failure. Already I have hurt a friend who had once been my teacher because she saw her first name stitched around two characters in a story. One character is the narrator, and the other character is the narrator's maid. And so being linked to a maid in any way as employer or employee inside a story offended her. She closed my book on me because I need, she wrote, to support myself as a human being. The maid in the story is white and Jewish, but the friend with the name is black. And as she sees it, this act of composition is racially charged in a very bad direction. Why did I use her name? For weeks, for months, I combed my insides as one combs a lice-infested head, looking for my stupidity, my racism, my thoughtlessness. Over this, I couldn't sleep. Why didn't it matter that I used this name to name both a maid and her employer? Why didn't it matter that this name is not an uncommon name, or that the maid is described as having very long white arms, a gigantic white hand? But it's a name. And for this friend, her name, even in fiction, even in poetry, is an enclosure, a singularity. And I will pay the consequences of hurting her probably for a very long time. I use names in my work to watch them expand and morph. The story is about a dying mother and snails and a broken friendship. Her person hadn't even occurred to me when I wrote the story until the friendship in real life actually broke because of the story. I used her name because her name means enclosure and because of its sound, which fell against the words mother and snails like a soft hand. After reading the manuscript, She who will now remain nameless, she who is not the maid, nor the maid's employer, nor my friend, nor my teacher anymore. She who, after reading the manuscript, was hurt when she saw her first name around both the body of a maid and the maid's employer. She who will remain here nameless expressed her hurt and then added, she especially didn't like me using her name since Francine Prose in another story in the manuscript is the mother. I wrote back, but Francine Prose is not the mother. Francine Prose is Francine Prose. Incidentally, the story she referred to is a story based on the children's book, Are You My Mother?, about a bird who asks a kitten, a hen, a dog, and a cow, and a boat, and a plane, and a power shovel if they are its mother. None of those things are the bird's mother. The mother bird is the bird's mother. I call my own mother. I tell her the story, and she said, she who will remain now nameless is not your mother. I am your mother, said my mother. And I said, I know she who will remain nameless is not my mother. What page are we on, I wondered. What the hell is happening here? Here was my mother, my real mother, sounding more and more like a character in a story I could have sworn I made up. I call Flannery O'Connor, who is dead and who is not my mother or my maid, and ask, so when you say art requires a delicate adjustment of the outer and inner worlds in such a way that without changing their nature, they can be seen through each other, how delicate are we talking? Because I think I have a problem on my hands. I think my fiction is leaking. Why did you shoot the moon, Mama? Why did you tear the dragonfly to shreds? Poor dead moon, poor shredded dragonfly. Originally, the story about the maid and the dying mother was named We Once Were Everything. It's no longer named that either. And yet, as Donald Barthelme says, words have halos, patinas, overhangs, echoes. I should have known better, or maybe I did know better. Names are very powerful. We know this from the Bible. When Adam, whose name in Hebrew Adama means earth because he was made from the earth, names the animals, one gets the sense the animals, if they existed at all before they were named, existed as fog. Names are like spells, like prophecies. In Toni Morrison's Beloved, Setha's baby ghost is called Beloved, Be Loved, because she is the embodiment of an impossible possession. While Stamp Paid is the one who knows the cost of freedom and provides for the slave a passage into it. In Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, when Piccola is raped by her father, her name ends at her inherited ruin. In Reginald McKnight's The Kind of Light That Shines on Texas, the only black girl in the class is a tall, heavy silentist called Ah So, as if she is the unfinished afterthought to the racket of a white world. In Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita, Humbert Humbert's last name is his first because he is the father of his own invention. And in Pale Fire, John Shade, the composer of a 999-line poem, is, like a shadow, the illusion of continued space. In Isaac Batsheva Singer's Gimple the Fool, Gimple is named for his quixotism, while Billy Pilgrim in Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five is named for his wandering between time and space. And in Paul Auster's City of Glass, Stillman, both the father and the son, are named for the stasis language has cast upon them. Among the Wolof in West Africa, a mother who loses a child and has another will name the child Kene, which means stay. I changed the name in the story about the maid. I changed the name that means enclosure. but not before it was too late, not before fiction sunk its teeth into reality. When we enter into fiction, as we enter into the world, we see what we want to see. If we expect everything to smell like mildew, things will eventually smell like mildew. And yet, the job of the good story is to take a scrub brush to our preconceptions, our prejudices, to the story we keep telling ourselves over and over and over again. The good story helps us find what's underneath. It helps us find the parts of ourselves that keep going missing. We add this to works of fiction. This book is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents either are products of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. We need to write this because part of us knows it isn't entirely true. So I'm going to read the two stories that I refer to here. The first one is Are You My Mother? And it's based on the children's book, Are You My Mother? Francine Prose, who is my mother, calls to inform me there has been an error, and now she is fairly certain she is not my mother, but someone else's mother. She speaks for a long time, at first nervously, then gradually with great eloquence. After a few hours, she begins to break up. The only thing I can make out is something about Mary's gorgeous hair. I don't know this Mary, although I wish I did. I pick at my nail polish. Lucky, lucky lavender. Mom, I say. No, she says. Call me Fran, and hangs up. I call my cleaning lady, Hillary Clinton. She doesn't seem to know who I am, though she cleaned my kitchen no more than 3 days ago. The stove is still glistening. Are you my mother? I ask. Silence. I ask again. Hillary Clinton? Yes, she says. Are you my mother? More silence. I stare out the window, sunk by Hillary Clinton's remoteness. I decide I will clean my own house from now on. After what feels like days, Hillary Clinton asks me what I'm afraid of. Her attention excites me. I answer swiftly. Mice, old watering cans, political realities, vibrant colors, hooks, Thursday, wounded things, Shep, sacred music. Who's Shep? Asks Hillary Clinton. My grandfather, I say. Silence, then a heavier silence. I look around my living room. All my upholstery is frayed. Hillary Clinton? Yes. All my upholstery is frayed. Silence. I wish I'd never called. It's so obvious Hillary Clinton isn't my mother. She doesn't care about me or my upholstery or my deepest fears at all. If she ever came into my room to tuck me in and kiss me goodnight, I would turn my face away. I send a letter to Jory Graham because if Francine Prose is not my mother and Hillary Clinton, my cleaning lady, is not my mother, there is a good chance Jory Graham is my mother. The letter is very beautiful and describes what happened with Francine Prose and Hillary Clinton and my upholstery and all my hopes and dreams. 2 weeks later, I get a letter back. Jory Graham writes, sounds like a case of overwatering. Same thing happens with my plants. Why is everything so goddamn difficult? At the very bottom, in very small writing, she writes, how can I be your mother when I am Jory Graham? I am not your mother. Have you tried Diana Ross? I have, in fact, tried Diana Ross. If Francine Prose is not my mother, and Hillary Clinton is not my mother, and Jory Graham is not my mother, and Diana Ross is not my mother, maybe John Berryman is my mother. I go to John Berryman's house and knock on his door. He is dead, but he opens anyway. He is wearing a salmon-colored sweater. Are you my mother? I ask. I am not your mother, says John Berryman, he opens the door wider, but I could become your mother. Shep, my grandfather, is there. He is wearing an identical salmon-colored sweater. I step inside. It smells like waffles and liver. Touch my sweater, yells Shep. I do not want to touch his sweater. Touch it, he roars. I reach my hand out, close my eyes, and touch it. It's incredibly soft, like God himself, he thunders. Touch John Berryman's sweater. John Berryman blushes and moves very close to me. I quickly touch John Berryman's sweater. It's as soft as Shep's sweater, maybe even softer. You know who gave us these sweaters? Who, I ask. Your mother, says Shep. Francine Prose, I ask. Francine Prose is not your mother, says Shep. Then who, I ask. Your mother, yells Shep. I look over at John Berryman. John Berryman, I ask. Shep laughs. John Berryman is not your mother. But I could become your mother, adds John Berryman. Shep tells me to hold on a minute, disappears into another room, and comes back with a third salmon-colored sweater. Your mother left this for you, says Shep. Put it on. I put it on. It is so beautiful. It is so beautiful, John Berryman begins to cry. I put my arms around him, and we are like one enormous salmon-colored sweater. Don't cry, I say. There, there, I say. What? Asks John Berryman. There, there, I say again. He sniffs and looks at me quizzically. It's an expression, I say. It means it'll be okay. But it won't be okay, says John Berryman. It will only get worse. A lot worse, adds Shep. How much, I ask. A ton, says Shep. A ton worse, adds John Berryman. Does my mother know? I ask. Of course your mother knows, says Shep. Will she make it better, I ask? She will not make it better, says Shep. Will she at least try, I ask? She will not, says Shep. Can John Berryman make it better? I am desperate. He cannot make it better, says Shep. He is only your pretend mother. Why won't my mother make it better, I ask. Shep looks at John Berryman. John Berryman looks at Shep. Is the salmon-colored sweater not enough for you, asks Shep. He looks more disappointed than angry. It is a very beautiful sweater, soft and warm and probably very expensive. Because if it is not enough, says Shep, give it back. I am feeling brave and sad and defiant. I take off the salmon-colored sweater and give it back to Shep. John Berryman begins to cry again. He is not a good mother. I put my arms around him. Without the salmon-colored sweater, I feel very small. Also, I am cold. I shiver. I climb under John Berryman's salmon-colored sweater where it is warm. He is sobbing now, heavily. It is like I am in an ocean and the waves are crashing. I close my eyes. And the next story I'll read is the story about the maid and the dying mother. And you can decide for yourself. And the name, all the names have been changed. And then afterwards we can do a Q&A. We'll have time for a Q&A. The maid, the mother, the snail, and I. The maid is not herself. She hands me a can of Easy Off and walks away. The kitchen is not clean. The bathroom is not clean. The beds are unmade. Something is bothering the maid. Her long white arms seem longer than usual. It's barely 8, and already she has dropped the mop, causing a serious bang and scaring me half to death. Now she is hiding in the bathroom, eating an entire can of sardines. I hear her pull back the tin lid to get to the last one. It sends a shiver through the house. Something is bothering the maid. The refrigerator's hum because of her is off. All the vegetables are dead. The milk, like a ghost, is turning. By noon, she will ask me, as she now asks me every day, if I love her. Why does the maid ask me this? Isn't it obvious? And then, half past the same hour, she will ask me what moon I am, waxing or waning. How do I know what moon? She has lost her sense of precision. Her technique is off. If she ever had a plot, her plot is long gone. She has forgotten to bring mother, who is dying in the living room, her pills. She has abandoned a pink sponge on the stovetop. The maid is not herself. It has been a lousy winter. The maid has begun to smell a lot like ash. Frankly, she has begun to smell like an entire house burned to the ground. She has neglected Bye-Bye Francois, the family parakeet, whose cage is in shambles. And now Bye-Bye Francois is not herself, though Bye-Bye Francois is more herself than the maid is herself, given the maid is less and less herself as each hour passes. She has replaced the grocery list with number one, a prelude to nothing, number two, a war poem, leaving me with no idea of what we need. Bread, eggs, sparkling water. It's anybody's guess. Who does the maid think she is? Herself or not herself? The maid and I once were best friends. I called her Lydia, and she called me Lydia, though our names were nowhere near Lydia. We knew how to be everything. Rubber, dirt, glass, wire. We even knew how to be children. We even knew how to be happy. Now the maid stands at the kitchen sink, still as stone. And I stand beside her, waiting for the dirty, dirty dishes to be washed and dried. Lydia, are you there? Lydia? No answer. I cannot stop thinking about the maid. Mother, who is dying in the living room, urges me to rest. But the maid is not herself. Of course the maid is not herself, says mother. How could the maid possibly be herself? I lie beside mother's quietly dying soft brown body and fall asleep and dream I am walking up and down the aisles of a supermarket. In my cart is an old orange. It costs $7,000, and when I open my purse, all I have is an ocean. We do not accept, says the cashier, who is really the maid, who is not herself, an ocean. The waves crash, which embarrasses me. I wake up against an area of mother that has been designed to rot. No doctor can explain why. It is possible the maid is a Jew, which could explain why the maid is not herself, though I have never asked her whether or not she is a Jew. Mother is a Jew, and I am a Jew, and father, who is missing, is a Jew. I read somewhere that some Jews escaped Poland by hiding in coffins. We are more or less ourselves, given our history, but the maid, Jew or not a Jew, seems more not herself than necessary. Around her head, she has begun wearing a silk scarf printed all over with tiny hatchets, hatchets she will never bury. The maid and I go outside. I say something and she disagrees. Snowflakes begin falling on her head, but not on mine. The maid points to a swimming pool in the far distance. You see that swimming pool? Barely, I say. As a child, I swam in that swimming pool. I didn't drown once. The maid and I hold hands and walk 11 blocks before we run into Sweetie Pie, my maid before my maid, who is not herself. Sweetie Pie is pink and fat. She shakes my maid hard until a small snail falls out. Sweetie Pie picks up the snail, cleans its shell carefully on her flowery dress, and hands it to me. Did you know, says Sweetie Pie, that snail shells and the inner ear follow the same spiral? No, I say. That is how you know the snails are listening. Oh, I say. I look at Sweetie Pie. I miss her so much, but not as much as I miss the maid who is not herself. I give the maid back her snail. She pops it into her mouth and sucks on it like it's hard candy. I am sorry, I say to Sweetie Pie. I know so little about snails, and now the maid who is not herself and I need to go home. Sweetie Pie looks at the maid hard. How is she with floors? She asks. Left to right or right to left? Nowhere, I answer. In the morning, I look in the mirror until my reflection thins enough for me to see Mother and Mother staring back at me, and then it thins again, and there's the maid. I scrub the house. I check on Bye-Bye Francois. I clean her cage. I wipe her perch. Bye-Bye Francois is not herself. Her eyes are black and still. I gently pet her small blue feathery head, but she turns her head away. I dust the sills, I beat the rugs, I polish the banisters, I wash and dry the stacks and stacks of dirty dishes, I change Mother's sheets, I brush her hair, I apply rose-scented gloss to her lips, I empty her darkening bags of fluid, I give her the pills. My work doesn't matter. There is always dirt. There are always things where they should never be. The minute I look away, what wasn't a mess will become a mess, and the mess will be a holy one. Are you fed? Asks Mother. No, I say, I'm fine. There are wonder cakes, says Mother. She touches her lips with her thumb. I left them for you somewhere, long ago and far away. I take Mother's hand. Go eat them, she says. I will, I say. Go eat them forever. I leave Mother to go looking for wonder cakes. I find a trail of wrappers leading me straight to the maid who is hunched in the pantry. Lydia? Lydia doesn't turn her head. Remember when you wiped all my countertops until they glistened? Remember when you swept up all the dust? Remember the broom? She slowly turns, then smiles at me for the first time in months. White and yellow wonder cake crumbs fall gently like snow from her mouth. I bring Mother a glass of water with a pink straw. She takes a sip, but the water doesn't reach her lips. It rises slowly, stops, gives up, and falls. This is what the end looks like, says Mother. How about that? How about what, I ask, though I know. That, says Mother. For a second she drifts off, but the bony sunshine snaps her awake. Your skull once grew inside me, says Mother. I know, I say. I know you know, says Mother. And now there are these falling children. Make it stop. I do something with my hands like untying a pretend knot. Thank you, says Mother. They have stopped, says Mother. Except for one. One is still falling, but she is quiet, and I don't mind. She takes my hand. She looks, says Mother, squinting up at the air, just like you. It is impossible to describe how much I miss the maid. I write her a note. Dear Lydia, it is so obvious you got into my collection. My apple snail, my great pond snail, and my trumpet snail are missing. I still have my red spotted snail, the crown snail, and all my mystery snails, 4. I didn't want to say anything to Sweetie Pie about my vast knowledge of snails. I didn't want to give it away. I was protecting you, Lydia, like you once protected me. I want to shake you like Sweetie Pie shook you until all the snails fall out. I want to jump into the swimming pool you never drowned in as a child. I want you to clean my whole entire house again. It is so dank. Forever yours, Lydia. I fold the note 7 times. I find the maid curled up on the disheveled bath rug. She is sound asleep. From her beauty, my heart just mildews. I don't think she will ever clean my house again. I open her gigantic white hand, then close it around the letter. I follow a long, thin blur of dirt back to Mother. You should have drawn a line, says Mother, Mother, between you and the maid. I did, I say, but it was shaped like an arrow pointing in the direction of my heart. There is so much grime in the air, it coats my skin and makes it sticky. Did you know, says Mother, Mother, that an assembly of snails is called a root? Mother, Mother's legs seem to be completely disappearing beneath the crumpled sheets. What's a root? I ask. A disorderly retreat of defeated troops, says Mother, Mother. That makes sense, I say. 1 week later, I look out the dirty window and see the maid standing in the yard. As if waiting for a trumpet to sound, her body has turned skyward. I leave her alone. I go to Bye Bye Francois's cage. Bye Bye Francois is not there. In her place is a milk snail. I've always wanted a milk snail. I peel it off Bye Bye Francois's perch. It waves its tentacles sleepily. I bring it into the living room where Mother Mother is no longer dying. I put the milk snail in her bed and climb in beside it. The bed sheets are so sour. I call for the rest of my collection to join us, the whole root. They will come. I am certain of it. I just need to be patient. They are snails, and it will, as everything does, take forever.